Tonight, in conjunction with the annual Fort Worth AIA Designs Award, we are honored to have Roberto De Leon, a fellow of the American Institute of Architecture and LEED certified accredited professional, who is partner and co-founder of De Leon and Primer Architecture Workshop. DPAW is a collaborative design studio recognized for work that draws inspiration from regional traditions of craft, fabrication, and building, placing an emphasis on the potential of conventional materials and construction methods, with a penchant for immersive research that points to contextual specificity as a thoughtful relationship between place, time, and locale. Place, time, and locale culture, and embraces the rigor of simplicity and precision with the underlying premise that innovation necessarily equals economy. The workshop was chosen for the 2010 Design Vanguard by Architectural Record, the 2011 Emerging Voices by the Architectural League of New York, and awarded the 2012 American Architecture Award by Voices. Okay, one more time. 2012 American Architecture Award by the Chicago and Athenaeum and the European Center for Architecture, Art, and Urban Studies. And then again in 2013, it received the American Institute of Architects Institute Honor Award for the Mason Lane Farm Operation Facility, which is a project that garnered attention for its innovative use of passive sustainable strategies. Most recently, DPAW received a second American Architecture Award in 2014 and another American Institute of Architects Institute Honor Award in 2015 for the Wild Turkey Bourbon Visitor Center. DPAW has been published in numerous design magazines and books nationally and abroad, and their work has been exhibited in significant venues, including the 2012 Istanbul Biennial, the 2011 Beijing International Design Triennial, the WOOD 2010 in Sweden. Is that pronounced WOOD or is it W-O-O-D?
It's WOOD.
Okay. I'm showing my ignorance. I'm a little out of my area here, so forgive me. For the 2014-2015 season, their recent work was again included in the 2014 Istanbul Biennial, the Contemporary Space in Athens, a traveling exhibit throughout Europe, and the 2015 Chicago Architectural Biennial. So this is very celebrated work, and I think we're fortunate to get to hear about it tonight. I'm excited to hear about the ideas behind work that's received so much attention. In 2016, Roberto was elected to the College of Fellows of the American Institute of Architects for his notable contribution to the advancement of the profession of architecture. And tonight's lecture focuses on a selection of DPAW's current work, specifically highlighting the design approaches and explorations of each project, as well as offering insight into the firm's studio culture. So please join me in welcoming Roberto De Leon.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, let's see here. I'm hoping I can negotiate through this. Well, what I'm going to talk about today is just kind of a range of projects that are just recent, current for us. Current as in under construction, nearing completion, but also recently completed. Usually I kind of focus a lecture on a very specific theme, but really I just want to talk about new stuff. So and there's a lot of sort of issues kind of ideas at play here that has become kind of a consistent sort of theme for us. I'll just begin with kind of talking about the our office culture, like just what is our environment like and all of that. So let's see, I'm not used to the split screen, but let's just see what happens. Okay, so a key part of our office is really traveling, having fun. We work hard, so we play hard. And that's a really important part of our office culture. So twice a year, we take the entire office, including summer interns and so on, to a mystery destination. I think they've all caught on at this point that we just go to somewhere warm and tropical, near a beach. But we usually just tell them to bring a carry-on and just be prepared to go anywhere. And then we actually just give them tell them the destination when we're actually at the airport. But so this is our 10th year anniversary, and we went to St. Thomas. This is total post-justification, but it turns out St. Thomas is the patron saint of architects. So, but we had a great time. So this is our office. It's just one big space. There are no rooms. We work on this long, sort of 80-foot-long table. It's kind of messy most of the time. We try and keep things tidy. There's two office dogs, and so when the mailman comes, it's really exciting. So this is kind of just other views of it. I'll try to go quickly because I want to leave room for questions in the end. So there really is a shop here, and so it's not unusual for our laptops to be, you know, covered in sawdust and things like that. There's a ton of office toys, like razors and a power board, and sometimes they just get too dangerous, so we have to make sure they're only played with outside. We tend to sort of obsess with documenting things. So this is like just a corner of the office. And to the left here is actually one of our summer interns' side projects, which is Origami A Day calendar. And it's kind of the benefits of things. We document everything, as I mentioned. So this is a food. This is one of the office dogs. And this is not, the viewpoint is always the same, but it's a very unusual thing of this dog that just eats exactly half of the food bowl and then won't eat any of it until we refill it again. But the odd thing is, this is always from the same position, so it's really odd to us that it's occurring from many different sort of approach points. You know, we go to a lot of AAA functions, and we also document every chicken and steamed vegetable dish. And then this one threw us for a loop because it was actually like chicken pot pie. We love to do our research, obviously, and so this is one for a project I'll talk about in a bit. But the interns kind of get carried away, and so what used to be our kitchenette is now a fully stocked bar. And we have this just a daily office tradition at this point that we drink a shot of bourbon promptly at 4 o'clock every day. You know, we often have like product reps happen to be in the neighborhood around that time and drop by. Again, the importance of building full-scale mock-ups, for example, this is one for Mason Lane Farm, is really important for us because it's a way not just to first explore materials, but a way to also show builders that this can be built and how it can be built simply. Even though it may look complicated. And so for us, it's also then a test of, like, how do we draw this? And how do we detail it? How do we even note it? Things like that. This is another sort of full-scale mock-up for an art collector in Louisville. This was a viewing ladder that is movable. And we were just, he's giving us the thumbs up for how far he's willing to climb this thing, as well as kind of a mirror polished stainless steel mast. This is sort of a tripod structure that's moved around this farm property that's filled with site-specific art installations. So this was a viewing ladder specifically for a Maya Lin earthwork. And so this was always meant to be moved around seasonally as things would change throughout a farm property. There's a vacant property behind our building that we don't own, but we just use it secretly to build larger things. And then this is usually always the case. It's really important for us to actually design on-site. So this is not an unusual occurrence that we actually pitch up a tent or tables, we bring our laptops, the client is sometimes there. But it's really an opportunity for us to just immerse ourselves in the site. So other times we'll actually like camp out and spend an entire week on-site. But again, designing the immediacy of the project site is really, really important for us. And it just brings to light things that you'd never know, like things like, can you hear the train pass by? Things like that. Or how windy does it get? And so on. So we really test things. This is another one project that we were testing with sort of transoms and laser levels for an art installation. In this case, we're trying to mark topography, literally, for our cut and fill site. For many that don't know, Louisville's on the Ohio River, so the flood condition is a really common occurrence for us. So the whole issue of sort of detention basins and things like that is really an integral part of sort of mitigating these flood conditions. We work with a lot of conceptual precedents. This is a very common site, stacked limestone and so on, and how that might begin to impact things like this is a massing model for a regional library in the southwest part of Louisville. We have a very specific sort of take on sustainable design. I won't go into this project in too much detail, but really, this was a test for us in terms of, at that point when this project was being designed, we were really sort of skeptical, frankly, of the kind of sustainable movement and why everything looked the same and it could be placed anywhere. And so we were really interested in how could we take advantage of sustainable strategies that were passive and economical and also very site-specific. And this was kind of a test. Like, we just said, let's just submit it for the LEED certification process and see what kind of points we get. We just wanted to get the baseline point. But really, we were just one point shy of getting a gold level status certification. So what we wanted to do with this was, again, introduce a kind of sensibility about the context when employing sort of sustainable strategies, but also that sustainability can be affordable. For us, it's really irritating, frankly, when someone says, "Oh, well, if you include sort of mechanized systems like a green roof, geothermal, blah, blah, it's only a 25% increase in your project cost." Well, you know, a lot of our clients, most of our clients, are not-for-profit sort of cultural groups, so there's not a lot of upfront money, and so we have to then include sustainability in a much more sort of integral way, and there's ways to do that. And this project was an example of that. But it actually is a project that sort of integrates the site and building design, and doing that in a very simple way. This project was again very economical, but contains a lot of elements that are really technically sort of unseen. This is kind of the feature element, which is a barn clad in bamboo. But this is a lattice structure. It holds not only large-scale farm equipment, but also is meant to dry square-baled hay. So we needed that kind of porosity, but some kind of rain cover, essentially. But it needed to sort of breathe in order for the hay to dry. We work with a lot of different techniques. Collage is an important one, just to get the immediacy of an idea out. It's not figured out, but we want to convey something about this is a series of elements, interactive elements for a park in Louisville. We build, good old chipboard models, and this describes how the massing of things informs then a building like this, which is a prototype building for the park I just mentioned. And again, this building also takes into account, again, these passive site strategies, so sustainable strategies. So this is right next to the Ohio River, so there is no heating and cooling for this building. We had to rely on just completely sort of porous building skin elements. This is in a floodplain, and its first year it wasn't a flood, and so it has to withstand things like tree logs, floating down the river. So there had to be kind of a bomb-proof condition related to this specific project. We use things like other software like Pepakura, which is a Japanese program that unfolds things. So that became an important element for other structures in this park in terms of how those same kind of kit of parts buildings can be unfolded to form shade structures, for example. There were hundreds of these, which of course are terrific things to assign your office interns. There's a lot. I hope this will go. Let's see. There's a lot of sort of animations that we use in the office, simply because many of our projects are meant to be moved around, And so to investigate things like how one building can actually look different in many different ways from different vantage points. This one is specific to a very large sort of 3-mile jogging loop that contains soccer fields and so on. And then what happens from day to night, you know, that these very industrial-looking structures actually become more lantern-like in the landscape in the evening. And so this is that same building I showed earlier, but actually this is very simply lit with just, you know, strip fluorescence with colored gels. So it's, again, there's economy here, but still trying to investigate what can we do with, in this case, off-the-shelf and prefabricated materials that could be easy to replace, requires no maintenance, and addresses concerns like public safety and so on. We don't work in a vacuum. The charrette process with clients is really, really important for us. And so this is typically how we work. For us, it's really not about kind of guiding the discussion as it is about listening or eavesdropping, because we will never know a project better than the client. And so for us, this is important in understanding why the program we've been given is what it is, because then we are then able to better understand how we can get the most out of that program through the design strategy. Of course, the translation from drawing, material explorations to building is really important. And so, you know, we get concerned when contractors actually don't miss these things in our spec book, like a Hello Kitty cover and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So for us, that again, the translation of drawings and, you know, design information is really, really critical, and we're very heavily involved in that during the construction phase. As you know, so we're based in Louisville, but our projects have since expanded to farther regions, and so the kind of lessons we've been learning with working with much more immediate or locally close projects has been sort of tested lately. And for us, it's a learning process in terms of how do we then execute the same sort of quality and sense of experimentation with projects and materials in much farther locales. And so that we don't have an answer for that, as it is. We're really still on that learning curve. And I just had a discussion earlier, you know, about the kind of this letting go of certain aspects of a project being very, very difficult emotionally. So we're doing projects like in West Virginia. This is a very large project for the Boy Scouts. I really can't show more of this. We're doing a distillery expansion for Stranahan's Colorado Whiskey in Denver. These are a series of massing studies. And how then they can begin to inform, you know, specific strategies to this specific site and locale, things like the quality of light, orientation, how immersive does the visitor experience get? How do we then take advantage of things like this is very specific to a product line that they do, which is based on snowflakes and sort of fractal geometry. And how can we then begin to rethink sort of timber construction? And so this is one of our current projects, another one in Rogers, Arkansas. This one is actually multiple buildings and takes up multiple blocks. And so it's a history museum in this very historic downtown core. And so it's very interesting for us then, how do we begin to knit together or begin to define an identity for a museum complex that is comprised of very distinctly different buildings that's dispersed, again, throughout a multi-block area. Let's see here. Okay, so I'm going to focus on, again, projects that are a little bit closer to us. This is Kentucky. This is the Ohio River, sort of. I guess you can't see my pointer. The Ohio River right there, Kirby line. Let's see if I can point this. Okay, so Louisville is right here. And so I'm going to talk about specific projects that have recently been completed. I'm going to talk, first of all, one that's here, which is in Knoxville, that is our most recently completed building. It's a visitor center for botanical gardens. This is downtown Knoxville right here, and the botanical garden, the arboretum property is right here. So it's kind of this strange hidden gem in Knoxville. It's within 5 minutes of downtown, but no one really knows about it because it's in a residential neighborhood. And so we did a master plan and identified certain sort of key elements of the property, how do you experience it in different ways. And this was the initial project, the pilot project, which was to do a visitor center for them. They initially wanted us to build a completely new building, but there was actually this abandoned or unused CMU block storage building that we said, you know, we can do something with this and also save you guys money, and it doesn't have to compromise the design. And so this is the existing building. Again, it's just a block building, it's just basically not used. And so we had kind of this very stringent budget of $180 a square foot, which also included site development, which was significant because we had to take care of things like how do you approach this building and so on. But we began to look at things like, okay, we're already reusing an existing building. It's a concrete block building, and it's pretty straightforward. This is the floor plan. So this is the easiest floor plan we've ever had to draw. And so the strategy was, well, okay, let's reclad this. Let's put a new skin on it, a decorative skin. Let's line it so that we can, it's insulated, so there's, thermally or sound. And then to consolidate the core programmatic elements to either end so that we could maximize the amount of flexible use open area, which is really for exhibits and sort of plant sales and potting classes and so on, in this center space. Introducing punctures that relate to the topography as well as to different garden entrances and so on, as well as viewpoints into the building and out of the building and through the building. So this is the resulting floor plan. Again, it's very simple. And we had to be sort of, we had to really transform this building. And so we, part of our process is really just documenting things, as I mentioned, the dog dishes, the chicken, all of that. But we actually went to this arboretum and documented every tree. So this is just a series of bark variations that you can find there. We documented every leaf type and so on. And this really began to inform the kind of exterior building skin for us. So there was a lot of just initial, attempts at things like folding some kind of material. And we had already done that kind of series of material explorations with the park buildings that were sort of bomb-proof in a sense that you really didn't have to do anything to them other than hose them down. And so we needed to introduce that kind of low maintenance aspect to this building. Of all the metal kind of panel products, expanded metal was really the most economical. It didn't matter if we did perforated steel or any of that. This was still always ended up being the most economical for us. And so, it's available in different gauges and extrusion patterns and so on. But again, we stuck to this because it was just the most economical. And then we just began folding it, like the kind of paper studies that we did, and just did that in-house. So we said, well, okay, what does this look like? Is it even interesting? Should we continue to pursue this? And we thought we could make something of this. And then we began to experiment with uplighting. We began to look at sort of heavier gauges. And at that point, after receiving our last two free samples of McNichols samples, that was it. And so we said, we have to do it now and just decide. And so we started to then partner with a metal fabricator as far as experimenting with how can you introduce pleats, what are the limitations, that empty field behind our office that we don't own. We set up this thing, which is full scale. And that color that you see is actually not a paint, it's a reflection from this. So this is an aluminum panel, and in a kind of anodized state, it actually begins to take on the color of its surroundings. And, you know, this begins to inform things like, should the diagonals be vertical or horizontal? And you can see on the left, the horizontal catches more light. And so that began to inform then how we can play with the module of this material. And then we were also simultaneously modeling it in Revit and looking at, for example, a south wall throughout the course of the day and then through the evening when we uplight that. And so this is the initial concept rendering. Of course, this has to be economical, and so we developed a series of folding patterns that used every square bit of the actual panel module. So there was we were trying to minimize waste, but it could also be prefabricated offsite or pre-bent offsite and just shipped, you know, stacked. And so this was kind of a series of that, just a close-up of one. And then just looking at how do we detail every possible condition from an edge opening to an exterior corner, and how do they overlap? What if something breaks? How do you replace it so that you don't have to take everything down? So all of that was really investigated. And so this is the resulting project. Depending on the light, this is very diffuse sky. It takes on very different characteristics. Night becomes this lantern. Again, depending on the time of day, it just sort of shifts in how the building looks. And then there's also a ceiling. This building's actually on a sloping topography, so there's an upper level terrace that then all the entire wall can open up and into an indoor outdoor space. So we were trying to take advantage of what the topography was already letting us do, and just taking advantage of that. It's more of the building skin, and this actually is not a blurry picture. It just looks that way. It's just this strange moiré effect between the lighting and the holes and the shadows that they cast. And then this is the gift shop without gifts. But again, using the garden, literally as a kind of painting or focal point within the gift shop. The ceiling then, we were concerned with, you know, this is a very big space with hard surfaces and so on. So we began to look at the tree bark again as our inspiration for this kind of coffered ceiling effect. We began to look at things like a kerf core plywood that you can really bend quite extremely. And so from that, we began to look at this kind of pattern. We looked at many different kinds of patterns, but this is the reflected ceiling plan. Again, it's really quite simple. This is actually pre-assembled, bolted flat, at a shop, and then it's shipped flat, and then it's actually installed by pulling it apart and lapping it together. So in a sense, we're sort of making expanded metal, but out of wood in this case, wood veneer. So this is the ceiling, and then by lighting it irregularly, we began to sort of allude to that whole like dappled sunlight effect that surrounds, from the trees that surround this building. And so this is opening day. So you can kind of get a sense of the scale of the space and what the ceiling is doing, and then this kind of relationship to exterior spaces. So we recently completed this in October. At the same time, we were also doing this project, which is in Guthrie, Kentucky. It's it used to be a very large, thriving city, but it's since been reduced down to a downtown core that really is just one block. So our project is really what you see in yellow. It's two historic buildings. They asked us this was really a structural stabilization program, but we told them, you know, for the same money, let's make this building usable. So if we have to make it structurally stable, let's also do something more with it. So Guthrie was important. There's a whole history behind this, but it was important at one point when the Elnin Railroad passed through this. This was a kind of a crossroads. The highway system since then bypassed all of this, and the town went into a decay. But for as a building, there was a lot of things we could really draw from. There's actually a railroad tie manufacturer just at the outskirts of town. And so there's a lot of really beautiful patterns we could draw from. There's a whole color coding system with respect to transportation. But this was the building. When we first went there, we couldn't even really enter the building because it was literally sort of collapsing in itself. But it had these really beautiful, you know, murals, painted murals. But you can see in the back that literally trees were growing out of it. And this is a project that we actually designed without ever really entering the building. It was just too dangerous. We sent one of our interns inside. And he took this photo. And so this is really what we began to... And this project is a really, you know, we at first thought this was not a real project, but once we went to visit and met with the community, we were just really drawn into their story. We wanted to help them. They were just sort of these underdogs that could really use help. And we said, well, you know, let's do something with this. And so this became kind of a really sort of emotionally sort of heartfelt project for us. We just wanted them to have a building that they could use. We went through the whole workshop process. This is at the Senior Citizen Center. Again, really trying to understand what their program was. So this results in things like, you know, notes and possibilities. And these are really coming from them. This is, you know, they tape down sort of certain programmatic components. In small cities like Kentucky, a really interesting kind of dialogue happens or process. So the mayor that you see with the glasses on the upper left, he for over a year and a half period of time would wheel a cooler full of barbecue to Frankfurt, state capital, give it to the governor who was on the right side. Governor would eat the barbecue, and out of that comes funding. So... So for a year, this worked. You know, barbecue, feeding the governor barbecue worked. And so they were actually able to raise money. There were some grants, of course, involved. But this is the basic kind of strategy for the building. That we had to basically put a steel cage, which is kind of the whole point of the project to begin with. But then we then introduced a kind of a core of very specific functions, like a gift shop. I should mention, this project is a transportation museum and a welcome center. So there's a kind of a gift shop here, you know, restrooms and so on. And then we introduce things like color, and I'll explain this later. Again, these are really based on sort of transportation colors that you typically see on highways. But basically, it's a shell that is usable for a whole series of uses. And they even use it for, church services, things like that. So the section is again, it's very straightforward. It's just really opening up the interior and then working with the, you know, Secretary sort of guidelines for preservation or working with historic structures. You know, we really needed to clearly differentiate new from existing. So we didn't want to present a false sense of history. So there was a color coding here at play, which is everything that's black is basically new. So new storefront. This is the restored exterior. Unfortunately, there was a facade that was here that was not part of city property, and the owner decided to tear it down. So we were really saddened that happened. So the city couldn't save it. So this is, I'll just walk you through very quickly, but for us here, this is which is really juxtaposing what's clearly brand new with the kind of the patina of the existing and the kind of leaving in place the kind of traces of its former use. The color coding, again, continues into these niches. Because this was really low maintenance, again, there's really only one paint color in here, and we just used strip fluorescence with color gel, so they can change this at any time. If they ever have to paint anything, it's one paint color. So I'll just go through this very quickly here. So this is without any exhibits in it. These are photos of it very recently completed. It's a double height space. And again, this really beautiful juxtaposition of the beauty of the original patina and the plaster work that remained, again, in relation to what is clearly brand new. This is also a project where we literally learn to deal with the skill sets of the contractor. And so this is the worst concrete work we've ever seen in our lives. And we said, keep on going, because whatever they did to fix it just ended up looking worse. So we decided this would be, let's just play with how bad this concrete is. And so it actually became this really interesting texture. And so this is the building. This a story, a backstory actually to this, which is secretly, while we were having these meetings, we wanted to be on the senior citizen portrait wall. And so we did get that. Our portrait is, our pictures are there. And at the same time, we were also awarded Kentucky Colonels, the whole office, for our work in helping us save this building. And so we were just excited to get, our tie from the Kentucky Colonel gift shop online. So that was a really, for us, it was a kind of helping the underdog project, and we really could not say no to this. And again, the power of this project for us was that, you can do something with very little. And that's, I think, probably a common theme in all of these projects I'll talk about. So who likes bourbon? I know I do. And people I was with today know I like bourbon. But so this is also recently completed the Wild Turkey Bourbon Visitor Center. This was the site. It's really dramatic. It's on a cliff overlooking the Kentucky River. Let's see here. This is the view before the building came to be, but it's on the Kentucky River. There's beautiful bridges crossing the site, or the river. And the river is, in fact, the source water for the bourbon. And at the same time, Wild Turkey, the reason they were doing this was they were actually bought by Campari. So it was a whole rebranding program that we had to really reinforce. And these were the two demographics that, these are their terms. The good old boy, who's always been a Wild Turkey fan forever, and the I guy, who's, kind of the more tech-savvy, basically your hipsters, that are more into sort of small batch, special edition things. But the one thing that tied them together was this term. And again, this is not our term. This is their term. And so this was the kind of irreverent take on that their marketing team actually had. So, there would be things like this, which really translated into this. And so there was a whole transformation of how this product was branded. Again, most people thought of it or remember it as kind of this really harsh liquid that, the 101 that you would drink very cheaply in college. At least, I guess some people did. So the labels, were changed. So the left was the original, on the right is the friendlier turkey version. Obviously, tons of references for us. There really is a wild turkeys roaming on Turkey Hill, and certainly the beauty of sort of this turkey plumage. This is a stuffed one in their original gift shop. And of course, the rickhouses where bourbon is aged, the whole making of casks and so on, the fact that it has to be, oak, and it has to be freshly charred, it can't be reused barrels and so on. The site itself had unique sort of characteristics, like this fungus that grows in every building, and so it's believed that it actually feeds on what's called angel share. It's the evaporates from the bourbon that's being aged. And even that is, at one point we considered it a material. And so this is barn wood from one of the things. So we just began playing with things like, can we shave off the very thin layers of it? Is the fungus a material? Was it hazardous? We did research, and it's a friendly fungus. And of course, things like this. This is ubiquitous in our region, the tobacco barn, and of course, so these quilt patterns that you see. But it's really kind of the product that was really kind of the star of this, because as opposed to many other bourbons, the reason Wild Turkey, especially the 101 product, has this kind of abrasiveness to it is that it's actually distilled to the proof, versus other bourbons there where they're distilled higher and then watered down to the proof. So an example of that type of bourbon would be Woodford Reserve. So in here, that full sort of unmoderated kind of experience with the bourbon product was an example. And then also the father and son master distillers, the fact that they actually liked to hang out with the visitors in the visitor center was a big part of it too. So so that all helped shape this project. This is the project. The whole premise of it was based on kind of oppositions or dualities and contrasts. So again, the good old boy, the I guy, and that kind of series of oppositions. So on the one hand, the building from afar appears to be very monolithic and simple. From another view, it appears very transparent and open. At closer range, you know, it begins to take on a much more tactile feel. Things like reflections and so on became an aspect of this building. I'll just try to go this very quickly. So again, the building skin, as you get closer to it, is really a much more intricate thing than when you first see it from this approach road. I'll just go through these. These are just different vantage points throughout the day. The one sort of organizing element in this, it's a really simple floor plan, is this this trestle element that takes you to an elevated overlook tasting room. And so the importance of movement through this building, that on the one hand it had exhibits, but it was really the act of moving through this building as part of the whole tour sequence, going through distilleries, coming back to this building, going to the tasting room and so on, was an important part of that. So spatially, the whole thing of constricting, opening, things get darker, things get lighter, views are opened up. That whole sequence of movement became very important for this building. So this ramp then culminates in this view that overlooks the Kentucky River. And we were taking photos. This woman, she just kept following us. I'll just go with this quickly here. But you can see here then, again, the whole sort of, the building transformed between being very open, very closed, and again, this kind of series of oppositions in the kind of experience of moving through the building. It's Bubba. I think this may be the last, let's see here. So walking back down, again, this is the kind of the trestle. Every gift shop, or every visitor center has to have a gift shop. This is probably my favorite shot of the photo. This encapsulates, I think, all the ideas that are really in this building, the kind of need to operate or relate to very, very different scales, the scale of the human being, the scale of the rickhouses, the scale of the landscape, and in this kind of... it's really sort of a series of extremes. These next series of slides show it under construction, so I'll just go very quickly. But you can see how it's really... straightforward. It's a combination of wood and steel framing, with trusses going in, a series of sleepers, again, and then the building actually being sheathed with its kind of decorative sort of outer plumage in a sense. What most people don't know is that all of the lattice work can actually open up, so this building can kind of look fluffy once they actually open. Everything's actually unhinged steel frames that you can see here. And so here's the lattice going up. It literally was like done piece by piece. Let's get this. But you can see how simple the floor plan is. And again, this was not on a lavish budget. So we had to do this very economically. Again, the reason I showed the construction is that it's really straightforward, the construction. The section, again, very straightforward. But you can see here in the series of long cross-sections that it's really a sort of a split-level building that descends with the topography. Again, the sections are a little bit, longitudinal sections, a little bit more... reveal a little bit more of the building. Let's see here. I'm going to... let's see how much time I have left. I'll try to keep it brief. This is a project that we are now just completing. It's the Filson Historical Society campus expansion. So this involves three buildings, which includes the Beaux-Arts building, which is their current facility. There's a carriage house right behind this, and then a new building that basically doubles their archival facility and sort of public, you know, outreach programs like lectures and so on. This is basically what they do. They collect manuscripts. There's like portraits. There's just a lot of manuscripts, and then really bizarre things like this that was purportedly, the typewriter that F. Scott Fitzgerald used to write The Great Gatsby during his like 1 week stay in Louisville. That's something like that. But you know, they would say, be careful, don't step over that, because it was just laying on the floor. And then this is a trunk where Daniel Boone supposedly carved his initials. No one believes it's the real thing, but we just all, it's just encased forever. But really, they do a lot of outreach programs, a lot of lectures, and the site itself is really interesting because it was it's in this part of Louisville called Old Louisville, and it was the site. So our site is project is right here, and this used to be the site of the Great Southern Exposition, 1905. And so there's this huge building here, this exposition building that was built in that area. You can see what this is. After that, these buildings were torn down, and so all of these sort of Victorian era buildings were built. So what we, they're all really elaborately detailed and so on, but we documented every building for a 9-square block, so we had one of the interns ride their bikes and just photograph everything. But we discovered that this is really developer housing. You know, there's a formula here, and they're all the same. They just have different ornaments to them, and so that was really important for us and something that we needed to relate to. So there was already a kind of a scale and a vocabulary and a character for a new edition. This is the figure grand diagram in 1905. Our project site is here. This is what's left of that. And then this is our site. So the site then is the existing mansion, a carriage house, and then a new building that relates to the kind of original fabric or the scale of that. This was a project where it was really important for us. There were so many agencies involved that we had to get them in a buy-in very, very early. So we reached out to everyone very early. The neighbors who were opposed to building anything new in this neighborhood, the Landmarks Commission that was really hesitant to approve anything, the mayor's office, the city commissioners, everyone, as well as the client. And so we really had to get a buy-in from everyone. And so this was the first building, actually a very large-scale project in this part of Louisville that had a unanimous yes vote. So it was really important for us to go through this entire process and not do it after the fact, but really get everyone on board at the very beginning of the project. And so this is a site plan. I believe there's maybe an animation will say this. So, and then also a kind of a plaza that is available to the community. So it's sort of a give back to the community. It's not gated off or anything. It's accessible day and night. And then why did we not build on the corner to hold that corner was actually something that was debated with Landmarks. They were the ones that actually suggested it was better to complete 1, 2, 3 buildings and not build on the corner because then we would have a missing tooth. And then obviously that would then hold a future edition, which I won't be alive by then. Oh my God. There's music to this? I'll try and wait. Okay, I didn't know that. All right, so this is a very early kind of depiction of when they went to fundraising. So you can kind of see the project. Things have changed. I'll go through that. But so this is a new building. This is basically the scale of sort of two houses. With a kind of an atrium that has a monumental staircase. This is the archival area, which doubles as a kind of display. This is all north-facing, so we can get away with this all this glass. But they can, for the first time, this building is the opposite of their existing Beaux-Arts building, in which it's actually inverted. So everything, the guts of the building are exposed, so the community really knows what it is. It used to be called the Filson Club, and so it was never seen as a kind of amenity for the community or for the region, but in fact it is. And then this is on the west side, a lecture hall, That, again, it's a sort of multi-use space. We began to look at, for this new building, again, in opposite to to the existing Beaux-Arts, which was built with a, you can see here the relationship to the three and the same kind of proportions. This new building was actually designed so that it exposes how we build today. So it's no longer about load-bearing masonry. It, in fact, is like, you know, a series of veneers. So we began to play with the brick as actually like this sort of paper-thin thing that could peel away, a series of sort of lined elements. So there's a wood inner liner. Again, sort of playing off the whole, like, the shutters in the existing homes. This is a second level, an overlook room. Again, it's a multi-use space. This is again a building that you really have to walk through, a series of buildings you have to walk through, so that exhibits are really kind of dispersed through. And it's almost like the original attic of the carriage house, which is this, that we found all those things at the typewriter. It was this really interesting sense of, like, you're sort of secretly discovering things. We wanted to sort of recapture that feeling of finding treasures. And then renovating certain areas of the mansion for research. And so the building has since been under construction for about a year and a half now. So you can see the building skin kind of coming into... these are more recent photos. The building's not actually won't be completed until next week. So I'm just a week early here. You can just see then how the building is shaping up, the kind of west facade. This is that north facade. This is the archival area. Again, this is always going to be sort of a changing series of views inside. This at night actually becomes very, very transparent. And there's a monumental staircase here that's really patterned after the these really elaborately carved staircases in these mansions. And then this is the more public area with a kind of an upper and lower level multi-purpose room. So the monumental staircase has since changed. We began to look at this kind of vocabulary, really just sort of pouring boiling water on how many different kinds of things we were really using. Instead of wood veneers, and we were looking at slats at the time for the lecture area, we just said, let's just go with slats for everything. And so we began to look at how this thing, as you ascend, might morph based on the profiles of very traditional balustrades. And so this is a mock-up in our office. And so as you ascend, it becomes this kind of portrait hall gallery, and they have a very vast collection of portraits. And so that was the rendering, obviously, and this is the castera under construction. You can begin to see again the profiling that's taking shape. This is that lower level lecture hall, looking at just profiling, wood. So again, to minimize waste, we basically use the inverse of the wood to create this kind of ripply pattern. We were alluding to things that were very about, the Ohio River Valley. So there were sort of like these watery effects, but again, not being too obvious about it, but just doing a little bit of just creating very sort of subtle moves and textures with a wood system, wood slat system. Again, these shutters, they're very large. They can close. There's a series of layers of screens that come down and can completely black out the room. You can see this. The wood paneling is still in place. The central sort of chandelier is not fully installed. And then we also, for the upper room, began to look at things like, I don't know why, but we had a piece of lucite in the office. And so we said, oh, that kind of looks cool with this. And what if we played with that? And so we, in Revit, I began to explore, what are the effects of this? And would this really be the effect? What was our bigger concern? And so this could be a banquet hall, depending on the lighting. It could be an exhibit space, again, depending on the lighting. It's all adjustable. Again, everything can be, the entire room can be blacked out. And so this is the resulting room. And you can see that the ceiling, again, depending on how the light hits it, it becomes very, very bright and luminous. And again, the kind of sheen, the shadows, it's always sort of transforming depending on the light and how you move around this room. There's actually things that drop down from the ceiling. Again, it's a flex space. And so from this new building, there's then this pedway that connects to the carriage house and then to the mansion. Again, everything that we've introduced here that begins to contact or physically touch or engage existing historical structures can actually be removed. So there was a reverse, it was important for us that there was a reversibility to this. And so this actually takes you through the carriage house, which, again, this is still in construction, but it's basically a big sort of exhibit space. This is the last image. So that will actually be completed next week, believe it or not, because we have to be. I'm going to end with actually a very small project. As I mentioned, at the same time we were doing Wild Turkey, Parking Day. Do you all know Parking Day? It's that one day a week where it's sort of around the world where there's the tradition of turning an 8x20-foot parking space into a public space. And it's supposed to be one day, and most people do, they roll out, sod or put hay and things like that, and it becomes kind of a park space for the day. But we still had bourbon on our mind at that point. And so we said, well, let's take, what's our thesis for this? What do we want to explore? We didn't want to just roll out something. So we said, well, let's just take one material and see what we can do with it. So in this case, our one material was a 2x4. And with that, what can we do with it? How can we actually make it a spatial experience versus just having it a bench and so on? So again, we were thinking about bourbon. So we thought, well, why don't we make it into kind of a speakeasy for the day? And so you would walk in through this, say your secret password, you would be handed a shot glass and a shot of bourbon. So this is the floor plan, how it relates to the street. Again, this fits within an 8x20-foot space. So this is the project. This is an actual Parking Day event. We had a lot of repeat visitors. And so you can see then that then this void that we cut out is in a different color. We actually had special shot glasses, the official DPAW shot glasses. And then we just gave these away. So that was supposed to last for only a day. But actually it lasted for more than that because we didn't want to move it and we didn't know how to move it. And so the community just started using it. Like, people would eat lunch, kids would play here. It's a great place to walk your tortoise. And then it kind of took on its own life, like its own sort of social media life online. Like, what is this thing? And kids actually began to trade toys, which was really cool. That this thing is being used in so many different ways that we never could imagine. And so again, that it was supposed to be Parking Day. The following year, it was still there, and the mayor decided to make it Parking Week. So we're like, oh great! So what were we going to do? We just decided to add to it. So we added these kind of chimneys that would belch smoke every 10 minutes, and we had to warn the fire department that it wasn't on fire. But we just kept on serving more bourbon, and so this is the kind of our topping to it. Again, just tons of bourbon. And then the city caught on because they actually sent a little wagon. They had no idea what this thing was. So they sent a little wagon to haul it away, and they just drove away because they clearly could not do this. But I want to end with this because this particular project for us was really important in that something this simple and so generic and not even intended to last for more than a day could take on its own life, and a community can then invest in it in however way they wanted. And to us, it was just really amazing to see how many ways it was being used. So so that project for us, it just did so many things. Like, there were a lot of photo shoots. It was a great makeout spot. Just all of these things, and the community really began to own it. And then once we said, we got served that the notice, and we told the, you know, our neighbors that we were going to take it down. They actually began writing letters to the mayor and so on, that they really wanted it there because that's where they'd tell people to turn left at the green thing. But, you know, this was never meant to last for more than a day. So we said, you know, it's never meant to be a permanent structure. So we chopped it apart. We gave parts away. Some things were put in a park. And some of it actually is in that empty field behind our office. So I'm going to end with that. But what I really wanted to I think that really tiny project for us really, again, I think summarizes a lot of the ideas that are in all these other projects at very different scales, very different contexts. But at the end of the day, it's sort of like what is the it's really our discussion today for the jury, which was what is the idea? What are we trying to explore? What is the rigor? And so that is a kind of a continuum or a continuing thing that as a studio we ask every day and we play with every day. So I'll end with that. I'll take questions. I'm sorry, I'm running long, I think.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
If there's a question, I'm going to use the mic. All right.
Oh, yes.
Here we go.
Thank you for coming. This was enjoyable. What do you find as the most challenging aspect of your practice these days?
The most challenging, I think the distance now, the distance of our projects. I think just trying to maintain control of the design process, because we now have to team up with other firms, you know, as I mentioned earlier to others that, you know, this is their first time having to have an architect of record, for example. And so for us, that's just so not a part of how we work. And so learning how to sort of negotiate around that and making the best use of that or taking advantage of that, things like construction, and making sure when things are under construction, we're literally at the site like at least once a week. And so it's important for us, even though you tell builders to ask a question before you build it, they never do it. So we just have to show up. So those kinds of things are becoming challenges. And I don't have an answer to that really, but those are becoming really problematic, especially when a lot of our, I think the details that we develop become, again, they look complex, but they're really not that complicated to build. They're really quite simple. And so how do you convey that? And oftentimes our studio is one where we actually bring, you know, it's where our first meeting is because we show the builder, like, this is what it kind of looks like, and this is what we've toyed with, and so on. So I would say the biggest challenge right now is the distance of issue of distance to the project.
Thank you. Thank you for your lecture. I do have two questions. It's a microphone, yes. How is so there's exterior and interior, and through the last century of architecture, the relationship between exterior and interior changed. And how did it come, or where did it start, that the facade gets so much attention? Is it related to the technique, to the new digital? So that's my first question. Shall I wait, or shall I just get the second question?
If it's related, I can answer.
Good. The second question is, what is the message behind as you started to introduce to your lecture? So I'm interested, is it kind of getting involved in a team to a subject or to a project, what you could call think tank? And how these think tanks from each commission are related or linked to new commissions?
Mm-hmm. I guess let me answer address the first thing about the kind of issue of exterior, interior. For us, they're sort of the same. It's not driven by technology, or it's really based on just starting off with a really basic material and seeing how else can we think about this. So it's not about form making, because the software allows us to do that, or it allows us to generate certain patterns or anything like that. I'm hoping I'm answering your question. But it's really, we approach the exterior, or the building skin, in the same way as we would approach the interior. It's still the same sort of sense of play and experimentation, and seeing the kind of intricacy or sense of craft that we arrive at, or that we're striving for, is really based on, again, economy. We want to see, because again, most of our clients are not-for-profit groups, so there's not a really luxurious budget for things. So what we're always interested in is how can we maximize that value of what they're investing in the project. And so that in a sense, always draws us to something really common and economical and readily available. And then it becomes the challenge to kind of reinvent how we can begin to think about or rethink what these systems and building materials can be. And so for us, I think that whole sense of making and detailing and, you know, either exterior or interior, they're inherently tied. And for us, oftentimes there is no difference, because the interior becomes the exterior. Like, for example, the series of or the prototype building for the park pavilion, that, you know, that the skin is the shape. And so there's no difference. And it was out of, again, economy, a sense of economy, and in that particular project, the need for kind of an indestructibility, because of the location specifically, and its program. It's a public park with no daily maintenance crew. It has to kind of survive things like vandalism, you know, things hitting it, so on. So that is, I think, I'm hoping I'm answering your question about that kind of relationship.
The function of the facade, how mm-hmm. did it change over the last 50 years?
I'm not sure.
It's informing into the building.
Mm-hmm. For us, I guess we just never think about it. We've never separated the two. I guess we've just never thought of it that way. I mean, I think certainly, it's always been based on, again, an exploration. And whether the two meet or not, maybe I can better explain it this way. We would never really do a building where there's like the architect and then the interior designer. For us, it has to be a whole vision. Not to say that it's not about furnishings, things like that. I'm talking about the coherence of the entire architecture between exterior and interior. I guess that's how I'd phrase that. Our kind of understanding of that and how we think about things. The kind of logic of how we approach kind of think tank mode, I guess is how you phrased it, between projects. It's a continuum for us, because we learn from one project and then we apply it to another project. It might not be the same material, it might not be the same form, but there's a technique that we discover that is actually could be, again, very economical. In the case of, I didn't talk about it tonight, but Mason Lane Farm, where it was about really stripping away material and making sure each element counts, down to the screw pattern, the galvanized wire ties that I showed the picture of the bamboo, how that's actually bundled together, how even that is like an exploration, and how you can introduce a micro texture. You would only even see it unless you're like right next to the bamboo. And so for us, it's a continuum. So it's just a learning process that we apply. And it might not even, I was telling other people here today that we're the worst firm to have drawing standards. We have no drawing standards because we can't reuse them again. So maybe a baseboard detail is one that we might have. But I think, that sense of rethinking the potential for a project, I also want to say that it's not just about the materiality of things. or the form making of things that equally important for us is rethinking program. And so a lot of these projects where they ask for flex spaces, you know, it's really, again, it's about gaining that, what is maximizing that value? How can you use that building or that project in the most flexible way, in the most, you know, in capable of multiple uses, let's say. And so, you know, program for us is just rethinking that is really, really important because that's part of, again, giving the client the biggest bang for the buck. Again, the whole process of charretting and really trying to understand why the program is why it is, why it's been handed to us this way. Oftentimes when we hear them talk about their program, we actually understand that that's not what they're asking for. And so we actually then have a little bit more free play about actually reinventing their program. So it's a combination of that, and then you know, then the building form and the materials and all that is almost a subset or a side kind of process. But the program is always the thing that, at least for me, I'm really, really, really drawn to. So.
If there aren't any other questions, thank you so much. That was just really, I think, generous.
Thank you for having me.